Tommy Nelson continues his study on the Song of Solomon. This session is titled The Art of Intimacy, Part 1. And it's important to understand the context of this message. So at this time, we suggest you stop the cassette and take a few moments to read Chapter 3, verses 1 through 11, and Chapter 4, verses 1 through 4.
All right. Well, it is a delight to see you all here again. I hope this is as big a joy to you as it is to me. I can't think of anything more significant than to talk to about 3,500 single people about sex. Incredible. All right, we're going to turn the sprinklers on in here in just a little bit. Tell you what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to look at the Song of Solomon in chapter 4, actually. And there's a paragraph just before it that will pick up some speed there. Song of Solomon, chapter 3, verse 6, and we'll go all the way through chapter 4. Let me tell you what this is about. Once upon a time, there is a fellow who visited a particular community of people that lived by a river. He came and he sat down with them by the river, and he began to eat and began to drink with them. And then all of a sudden, out of the river, by his table, comes this great big 14-foot crocodile, and it takes this person's arm off, just chomps it. And he is immediately alarmed and horrified, and the people are immediately horrified, but they quickly subdue their horror, and they go about shuttling the fellow off to aid, and they go about eating and drinking. And the fellow says, "Didn't you just see that there was an enormous crocodile that just took this fellow's arm off?" And they said, "Yes, there are, and there's a number of them that have eaten people all during the years. However, it is impolite in our culture to talk about crocodiles." And so he noticed that, and he began to notice in the village that there were a great number of people that were missing great big chunks out of their body. And he noticed there were a number of people that were missing arms and legs, and it seemed that everybody in that little community by the river had some loved one that they had lost to a crocodile. And yet they never would discuss it because it was impolite in that culture to discuss crocodiles. And so without any discussion, things just went on, and people were maimed, and people were chomped, and people were hurt, and people died, but no one ever discussed it. No one ever pointed out where they lay. No one ever talked about how they get to you, because it was impolite in that culture to talk about crocodiles. Sex. We don't talk about it. Where do we not talk about it? We don't talk about it in church. Well, where do you talk about it? In the home? No. How many of you did not discuss with your parents about sex? Would you raise your hands if you did not discuss? You just kind of figured it out on the Exxon wall, all right, like the rest of us did. You don't talk about it in church. You don't talk about it in the home. Where do you talk about it? School? No, we forbid talking about it in school. And yet a great many of you have great big chunks that have been taken out of you by sex. Some of you have been maimed, and all of us know somebody that has been cost dearly by sex, but we don't talk about it, even though you have in the Bible the Song of Solomon with 8 chapters, and 2 chapters let you watch a couple make love. Bold face right in front of you to show you how to do it, but we don't discuss it. Until you get married, and now it is not something that you don't discuss. Friend, it is a big issue, and it's glaring, and the issue of sex, romance, and its sanctity demands an answer. It demands some words, but instead, we try to sweep it up under the rug, and there is pain indeed. We're going to look at how to make love in the Song of Solomon. Watch this. I want to point out just one thing as we get into the text. You have seen a verse mentioned twice thus far. In their dating relationship, the woman that was so respected and so admired by this man said, "Let his left hand be around my head and his right hand embrace me." She said, "Sustain me with raisin cakes." And this man said, "Don't awaken love until it pleases." And their patience took them last week into the courtship, into the deepest discovery of the little dove coming out of the rock, the commitment to protect their relationship, and it went deeper. And the woman, remember, called her young stag to the hills of Bether. Get the tape if you weren't here. to give her breast completely to this man. And he said, don't arouse and don't awaken love until it pleases. That's twice. And now their restraint and their patience and their holiness will take them into the deepest blessing yet. Singles, make a note. Every time thus far that they restrain themselves in their normal desires, God gives them greater blessing. And now we get the wedding. It's interesting that in 6 through 11 of chapter 3, you see a wedding. Make a note, this couple does not live together. This couple does not move in together. In one survey, it was found that 80% of the couples that live together get divorced. 60% married by a justice of the peace get a divorce. 40% married in churches can get a divorce. And those that study their Bible daily, it's one out of every 1,051 that get a divorce. You don't simply move in. You make a covenant before men and before God. That is why when I do a wedding, what I will do is I will stand down on the bottom. I will step over the ferns and go down to the bottom. And I will deliver to the crowd a welcome, a thank you, and God's purpose for marriage. But I don't take the top step until I step up, I motion to the guy, I have them turn, and I make them vow. In the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, I will not divorce you. And I will treat you with kindness and love and tenderness and sanctity, you and you alone, because that is the essence of a marriage. Is a vow in the name of the Trinity, and you do not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. So this couple makes a vow. I just want to show you six things about a great wedding. Would you notice in verse 6, the first thing about a great wedding? It borrows the language of the Exodus journey, where God went before Israel in a column of smoke. And it states, what is this coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke? It pictures the husband as a similitude of God. As a holy man. I did a wedding one time and I got chills watching this lovely blue-eyed girl look into the face of this handsome young man. It was right here in Dallas, and she said something I had never heard. A lot of girls assume it, a lot of girls think it, but she said it in front of God and everybody. She looked right into his eyes and said, thank you for keeping me pure. It was a precious thing for honoring her. He was a man of God. And if you'll look at the next thing in verse 6, it's a time not just of divinity, but it's a thing that is of sweetness and celebration. He comes perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with the scented powders of the merchants. It's a wedding is meant to be a celebration. Best wedding I've ever done. First Baptist Dallas, a number of years ago, a guy that's one of the leaders of the Hispanic community here in Dallas, his name is Vince Gonzalez. He came to Christ at our church, at Denton Bible Church. We called him Vicho. He married a girl named Rhoda, and a Hispanic girl, and they had a wedding that had the sanctity and the holiness of Christian marriage, but it had the unique flair of the Hispanic and the celebration of the Hispanic. And the wedding started, and the first thing was myself and the other pastor walked to the front, and I just watched it unfold. And through the back, there came these guys, and there were trumpets blaring, and they were carrying Christian banners, all right? And they came up to the front. And then they had dancing girls. Yes, First Baptist Dallas. And these dancing girls came right up here. And then came the bridesmaids. Then came the groomsmen. And then came Rhoda and her father. And she turned, and amidst the pomp, the crowd came to their feet. And this father says, all things have been done in order. This man has courted and loved and done my daughter proper. And then he cries to the back, Vincent, come get your wife. And the doors swing open. And here's Vincent. And I said, man, that is a wedding. And it is a time of celebration. Verse 7, it is a thing of protection and safety. Have you ever gone to a wedding where you silently prayed the entire time for the girl that was about to be subjected to this ogre? Or to this dear fellow that was in some sort of amusement marrying the queen of the harpies, and you knew he was about to get into trouble. Verse 8, look at this, or verse 7, behold, it is the traveling couch of Solomon. So they're carrying him on a sedan. He is coming to the wedding feast. 60 mighty men around it, the mighty men of Israel, all of them wielders of the sword, expert in war. Each man has his sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. Girls, how would you feel if you came up the aisle and there's about 60 groomsmen, all with 357s? All right? No, you would say, I am safe and secure. This man protects me. And that's the way you're meant to feel. Another great wedding story. Did a wedding, it was at Denton. And I heard a fellow say something that everybody assumes, you all vow, but I never hear a guy say it. He turned to his wife. His name was David Miller. His wife also happened to be Rhoda also. And he looked at her and he said, I will never, ever divorce you. And he made his commitment in the name of the Trinity. I will never leave you, and I will never forsake you. And she is safe in his arms. Nothing shall separate us from the love of Christ. And that's how a woman should feel in the vow and in the integrity of her husband. She says, I am safe. You keep going in verse 10. There is strength. King Solomon made for himself a sedan chair from the timber of Lebanon. Fellows, he is strong. Dr. Howard Hendricks of Dallas Seminary said one of the most amazing books he had read on marriage was by a secular counselor after 38 years of counseling made an observation about bad marriages. And do you know what the secular guy made in observation? It's as depicted in the name of his book. It's entitled, Passive Men, Wild Women. And he said that he discovered that where you get a man that in his job is creative and passionate and zealous and ambitious, but he comes to home and he is flaccid, he is opinionless, he is a bad listener, he is vacillating, he is uncreative, he is non-communicative, he is not humorous. It is not that the woman gets rebellious, he says, they simply get mad. Fellas, no woman wants to marry a weak fellow. I don't care what a woman says about submission, they want to have a man that they revere enough to trust her life to him. I quoted you a couple of weeks ago the great statement of Gloria Steinem, we women have finally become the men we always wanted to marry. Women are looking for men, not abusive men, not for quick-tempered men, but men that have the strength of the cedars of Lebanon. Keep watching. Verse 10, he is splendid. He made its post of silver, its back of gold, its seat of purple fabric, its interior lovingly fitted out by the daughters of Jerusalem. He is rich. This man is a Rolex. He is a Rolls Royce. He is the best thing going. She has not settled for a Pinto of a gentleman right here. Verse 11, go forth, O daughters of Zion, and gaze on King Solomon, with which his mother has crowned him. He is majestic, and she wants all of the women of the nation to come and look at her husband. Great quote. They said to Ruth Graham one time, your husband travels sometimes 7 months a year. What is it like to have your husband gone 7 months a year? She said, 4 months or 5 months with Billy Graham is like a year with any other man. What a studly thing to say. She was saying, I've got the best there is. I've got a studly guy. The little time with him's better than any other man. And that's how she feels about Solomon. She's proud. She wants all women to look at her husband and to everyone to think, what a wonderful woman she must be to get a guy like this. And in verse 11 at the end, on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of heart, you girls, you hold out, keep your standards high. Don't you sell out. You stay holy, you stay pure, and there will be a day when the doors will swing open and your mama will stand up and they will look at this man that they have prayed for and look forward to, and your friends will applaud you and be happy, and guys, you will step into the most blessed, wonderful relationship that humans can have this side of heaven if you do it right. But if you compromise, you have committed yourself to something far inferior, and my friend, you will not have just a little bit of hell on this earth. And you may quote me. So this woman has held out and God has blessed her. Isn't that a good wedding? Chapter 4, verse 1, we are at the Sheraton. this couple's going to make love. And let me tell you what he's going to do. He's not going to lay a glove on this girl till down about verse 11. He's going to kiss her. He's going to undress her. He's going to talk to her. She's going to invite him in. And then he is going to consummate his union. And then God is going to speak and say, go for it. Rough translation. You think I'm kidding? Watch this. Chapter 4, verse 1. I'm going to show you in this next chapter. What have I got here? 8:15? Man, I got at least 40 minutes. I'm going to show you 10 different aspects of divine sex. 10 different aspects of how love is meant to be lived out. Dr. Ed Wheat, I believe it was, wrote a book entitled The Act of Love. And it is. Verse 1 down through verse 4. How beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. They're in what is called the bridal chamber. Let me get something clear with you. Whenever in that culture you would get married, the guy would go to get his wife in his sedan chair. They would come to the wedding feast. Everybody would come to the party, and they would go into a room. And there they would stay as long as they wanted to while everybody was out having a party. And they would consummate their wedding. And then they would come forth. We put the tin cans on the car and send them off. They would go off and consummate their wedding in what was called the bridal chamber. And then they would come out and everybody would go, yay! All right. So, you know. And this is not uncommon in a lot of cultures. The Indians used to do it in a teepee, and everybody would stand around and bang on pots, you know, and stuff like that. Happened to me at my honeymoon, incidentally. Some idiot watched me check in. Always be careful when you check in to a motel, because somebody will see you and at a very inopportune time will whomp on the door. I'll let that go. Chapter 4. She still has on her bridal veil. And he looks through that veil and he says, your eyes are like doves. You are so tender. You are so sweet. You are so gentle. You are so lovely. Your hair is like a flock of goats that's descended from Mount Gilead. I might ought to help you with that, fellas. This fellow looks at her hair. Incidentally, what he has apparently done is this. It's a very sensuous thing. He has taken her veil and laid it back. Perhaps he has undone her hair, and her hair comes down. And it's like goats on Mount Gilead coming down. 2.5 tribes of Israel stayed on the other side of the Jordan because the cattle land was so good. And one of the chief areas was called Gilead. When you talk about the sheep of Gilead, you're talking about blessing indeed. And so he looks at her hair like the blessing of God coming down. And you can just see him lifting her veil, undoing her hair, stroking her hair. Verse 2. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes that have just come up from their washing, meaning that they are clean. Women, brush your teeth. Ain't nothing like a funky mouth old woman. You put that veil right back down. Now, what he's doing is he's looking at every little part of her body and saying, you are fantastic. Something came to me. I did a conference one time with the Baptist Student Union, and I never forget a girl coming up after I taught this text, and she said, you know that deal on the teeth? She's looking a beautiful girl. She says, what if you have this problem? She grabbed her teeth, boom, popped them right out. She said, childhood problem. I said, well, you know, shoot, I don't know. They have just come up from their washing, all of which bear twins, meaning that they are straight. And not one has lost her young, meaning that they are there, what this fellow has done. It's you can just see him here looking at her mouth, at how beautiful her mouth is, and the loveliness of her teeth. In verse 3, your lips are like a scarlet thread. You can just see him tracing with his hands here, ladies, her hair, her lips, at the definitiveness and the Verse 3, your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. Now he is looking at the rosiness of her cheeks. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built on rows of stones, which are hung 1,000 shields, all the shields of the mighty men. He has now gone from her lips to her cheeks, right down to her neck. He's moving down her body. Point one of sex. You notice that this fellow has not gotten physical. He has spoken to her. The first key to great sex, fellas, is called romance. Let me tell you what the word romance means. A lot of us don't even know. Back in the time of the fall of the Roman Empire, whenever Latin was the lingua franca, the common language, the different places in Europe would get together and they would come up with their own derivation of the Latin language. That you would have this kind that would speak this one speak this one. And it got to where, if you had a formal document, you would put it down in Latin. A wedding certificate, a coroner's report, certain kinds of writing. But whenever you would speak of things of passion and love and poetry and heroism and chivalry, you would tell it not in classic Latin, but you would give it in what was called the vulgar tongue, the language of the common man. And so it got to where classic Latin was formal, but things of passion, things of the common man, even ribald stories, dirty stories would be in what were called the Latinish tongue or the Romanic tongue. And it got to where the term romantic was talking about something that was not merely formal and legal, but that which was passionate and that which was full of love. And that's what we mean today by romance. Fellows, when you get married, you will sign a wedding certificate and you will have a formal Latin relationship with your wife. You will make the money, you will give your life, you will have the insurance. You will take care of her till death, but marriage is far more than a contract. It is romantic. It is vulgar. It is coming something out of your passion. It is out of your heart. And this drives women crazy, merely to have a legal document with their husband who cannot express deep down how he loves them. This man tells her from her eyes, her hair, her lips, her teeth, her cheeks, her neck, you are wonderful. Men use romance to get sex. Women use sex to get romance. That's a cliche and it's true. God gives us different drives. Gary Smalley put it like this, men are microwaves, women are crockpots. A man is a microwave. He can have sex now. Bing! It don't matter where, in a parking lot, on the roof. You can have bad communication. You can just duped it out. It don't matter. That's the way a man is put together. A woman is a crock pot. She heats up slowly during the day. It's a rigged deal, guys. This means this. You got to start loving your wife early on. When you don't take the trash out, when it's a February about 10 degrees and you make her go down to the snack and pack or whatever you got down there and fill it up, don't be coming home like David Niven, you know, because she remembers that. She warms up slowly. That's the way God rigs it. To be a man, to have great sex, don't even think you have to be a perfect body. No, don't even think you have to be even handsome so much as you are a tender, loving, kind, gentle, appreciative, not taking for granted man. There's all kind of great-looking guys that have lost their wives to bald-headed guys with pot bellies that simply knew how to romance their wives. Oh, yeah. See, if women had guys' sex drives, we'd have never gotten nothing done. We'd be in the Stone Age. We'd just be having sex. As a matter of fact, guys' ultimate fantasy is for their wife to have their sex drive. But if men had women's sex drive, we'd get a lot done, but there wouldn't be no people on the earth. You'd have 600, 700 guys hanging around. And so God has rigged it like this. And fellas, how many married guys we got? Got some married folks? Let me put a little word to you married guys. What we as married guys tend to do is we are effusively romantic in the courting process until we get them. And we'll send them flowers every day for 6 months until we get them, and then we won't send flowers for 10 years, because a man will tend to bag his wife and mount her like a bass or an elk, you know, instead of really being tender continually. Until Mother's Day or Valentine's Day, and he backs the truck up of candy and all this stuff. Fellas, you got to keep your flowers fresh. Let me tell you, Sunday was Mother's Day. You know what I did? I take a 3x5 card, and I just take it before church, and I write on it. And let me tell you, I'm a hopeless romantic. And I write on the card, "Sweetie, I love you for being my wife, and I thank you for being the wonderful example to my children, my sons. Thank you that you've never dishonored me. You've never given me thing any but happiness and love." And I went on, and I just wrote it on the back of a 3x5 card. I was teaching Luke 14, and I inserted it in Luke 14, in her Bible. And I called out the text in church and watched her. And that's the way that a woman is. You know, you can bring lots of flowers, but I'll tell you what's even greater. It's just complete spontaneity. You show up, fellas, with a little, one of them little deals from Skaggs, a little plants, a little cactus. Spontaneity is always seen as sensitivity. If I greet a guy's hand at church, in church, he thinks that I'm efficient. But if I greet him in the parking lot, he thinks that you know, we're a real loving people. In the same way in marriage. Fellas, I want to ask you a question. Are you going to be able to be a romantic guy? I mean, a guy that can share at level 3. Not just cliches, not just information. You can get down there. And I want you to know, I still get off just sharing, telling my wife how I love her. And as a matter of fact, I can kneel down in front of my wife and look into her big green eyes, and I can say to her, "I want you to know," and reach up and put my hands on her face and say, "I love you and I thank you for loving me, and you are a precious soul." I can take her at night and lay her on my arm and just get on my arm over her and stroke her hair and reach down as deep as I can and tell her how I love her. And today, I've been married 20 years, I weep. I cry still because of the reaching down to tell her how I love her. And that's the sweetness of marriage. So marriage starts with romance. A woman's greatest sex object or sex organ is her mind. And you've got to be able to talk to her. And ladies, if that fellow is an abusive fellow, if he is an angry fellow, a short-tempered fellow, if he is a hostile fellow, an immoral fellow, a dirty fellow, if he is an unkind fellow, I'll assure you, your mind will go south and your body will follow. You will not feel like giving yourself to a godless man.